foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more. It's blood.
That was Emma's Revolution, and I'm Marcy Winograd. Welcome to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and lots of other community radio stations, such as KBOO in Portland and KCSB in Santa Barbara. You can also hear us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Do check out our website at codepink.org, where you'll find the latest on our campaigns and all of our radio episodes and podcasts. On this Code Pink Radio podcast, we bring you segments from a recent Code Pink Congress program, Defeat Biden's $95 billion War Supplemental, a supplemental to his $886 billion military budget. The Senate passed the bill. The House has yet to debate it. The Senate bill includes another $14.3 billion for weapons for Israel's genocide in Gaza, $60 billion to continue the war in Ukraine, bringing that total to an estimated $170 billion, and almost $8 billion to further militarize East Asia for a confrontation with China. The bill also includes $9 billion in humanitarian aid to be split between Ukraine, Israel, and Gaza. In other words, a few sips of water before the bombing resumes in Gaza. As if that isn't bad enough, the Senate bill also includes a prohibition against U.S. funding for UNRWA, the lifeline for water and food to Gaza, to threaten mass starvation for over 2 million people. Finally, there is a provision that allows President Biden to send unlimited amounts of weapons to Israel without the legally required notification of Congress. All right, now we're going to go to a conversation between Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, prolific author, and Motaz, known as Taz Saleem, who's a Palestinian-American residing in D.C. He's completing his doctoral studies in clinical psychology. His father grew up in a refugee camp in northern Gaza. Currently, the vast majority of Saleem's family on his father's side, cousins, aunts, uncles, are living in Gaza, where they have been displaced on several occasions. Tragically, the relentless onslaught against Gaza has claimed the lives of many of Saleem's family members. Taz has joined Code Pink's Capitol Hill delegation to tell lawmakers this genocide has to stop. So with that, I thank you so much, Motaz, for joining us. Medea.
Merci for yes. Introduction, and thank you, Medea, for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
Terrific.
Well, we are so appreciative of you joining us many times in Congress. In fact, day after day, and I hear your testimony, I look at your face in anguish, and I think how difficult it is for you to be doing this. So maybe we could start out about what your own situation is and why you have been going to Congress with us.
Yeah. So my father's from Gaza. And so I have almost the entirety of my family on my dad's side there. That's nine. So he's one of 10 siblings. So I would say 8 of my aunts and uncles are there, as well as many numerous cousins. So it's been quite difficult in terms of just dealing with the day-to-day. Especially I find that in most spaces I'm in throughout my day, there's like this almost forced normalcy to everything. Everyone just is trying to go about their day and pretend that everything is fine. And unfortunately, I don't have that privilege because my heart's always in Gaza. I'm always thinking about my family there. I'm always trying to be in contact with them. And there are many days where many days pass by where I have no contact, and you're really sitting there just thinking, are they still alive? Are they Have they passed? Or, you know, it's just like a horrible, horrible situation to be in.
So could you say what your experiences have been in Congress? What might have been surprising to you? Maybe some of the positive and negative examples.
Yeah. So going to Congress has been, it's been on one hand great. I'll start with sort of the positives of it. For one, Medea, like you're the fact that you organized this and like I joined pretty late is just, it's crazy that you've been going there every day for months now. I think the most positive thing is just the people who come, even if for a day, even if for a few days, or even the ones who have been coming very regularly, just being able to be in this space with a lot of like-minded people, with people who look at what's happening in Gaza and in Palestine and, you know, refuse to just say, okay, I'm over it, or what am I going to do? Or you know, these aren't my people, why should I care? No, they see that there's a genocide happening, and their humanity sort of compels them to do what I think is right, which is to go and be in front of all these congressmen and these senators and to say, hey, like, this is enough. Enough is enough. So, I mean, in terms of some of the positive interactions, which are sadly far and few in between, there's, for example, like Mark Pocan, who is a congressman. I think his district like encompasses Madison, Wisconsin, was very supportive. We talked about how his like own efforts to try and call for a ceasefire, to raise awareness about Gaza. And also he himself told us that he provides funding to UNRWA, which is just like incredible. And I think other sort of positive experiences are any room we go into. This is really just like an encapsulation of this, what's happening in Gaza and how it sort of is reflected in the discourse and in people. Any room we go into for any senator, we've seen a lot of people sort of like we'll be talking with the chief of staff, and in the back, all the like interns or stuff are just like sort of nodding their heads with us and like intently listening. And so you have all these like lower level people trying to like hint their solidarity with us, as well as I one time got like a thank you for what you're doing from someone who was working in the cafeteria. So, I mean, that's, I feel like a reflection of like what the people feel versus what those who are in these systems of power are doing. And so switching to, I'll go sort of a middle area where a lot of the, and you can speak to this because I know you've met a lot more of the actual senators or Congress people, but some of the most unfortunate, I guess, interactions that I've had with staffers or you know, the actual senators is you'll have these really, really sort of outwardly kind staffers who will be so nice and so welcoming and you know, have a seat, and they're listening intently. And I'm, you know, I, every time I go to talk to them, I always just share my own personal story in hopes of trying to like appeal to the humanity. And I talk about how I, you know, I've lost numerous family members. And what ends up happening is this really weird thing where they're sort of on the outside being really nice, but then at the same time, they'll say, you know, but it's unfortunate that, you know, we can't, like, our hands are tied, or just give a lot of excuses as to like, that's not realistic. I'm trying to be realistic with you. And just very, very, very invalidating. And then, you know, there's the other end of this the spectrum, which is just straight up very disturbing incidents of like for example, the hearing we went to a hearing last week, which was on the Houthi, the Iranian proxy Houthi threat to trade. It was really just, you know, like you had all of these, like both Republican and Democrat Congress people, and they had these witnesses in front, and it was this really, really, you know, as especially for me, that was the first time I've ever sat in on a hearing in Congress, and it was just, everyone was just like reaffirming what everyone else said. And even those witnesses they had in front were all these like think tank heads who just reflected back to the congressman like the same points and pretty much said like, everyone was just like agreeing with each other. And the whole thing was just a farce. It was like, what are we doing here? And I can't believe that this is like what happens behind these closed doors, so to speak, where it's just like, there isn't any actual, especially when it comes to the issue of Palestine, there isn't any actual real legitimate discourse about, okay, what can we do here? Gaza wasn't mentioned once, ceasefire wasn't mentioned once. And even one of the witnesses who we sort of like chased him out after, chased after him when they were done. And I told him like, why did you not mention Gaza even once? And he got mad at me and he was like, because it's not about Gaza, which is just an absurd thing to say when the Houthis, as well as all these other proxy groups, have clearly stated like, you end the aggression on Gaza and we will stop our attacks, or we will stop, you know, the Red Sea blockade. So just, it was really a very like clear cut moment of how like not in touch these people are.
Well, I wanted to pick up on a couple of things that you said. One is about the people who come, and that gives us inspiration. The diversity is incredible. We are young, old. In fact, there are several times where we've had school children come and join us, Montessori schools. We've had a group called Teachers Against Genocide that have come with parents and children. We've had Doctors Against Genocide who are on their own doing lobbying every single week. And sometimes we join with them, and they are very effective when they talk to the members of Congress. We always have Palestinians, and we make sure that they're the ones who are the first voices that are heard by the members of Congress or their staff. And it's always changing. Never is there the same group every day. People are coming in from all over the country. They come in by train, they come in by plane, they stay for 2 days, for 3 days. And we help if they need to put them up. Some people put a GoFundMe up to raise money so they can come here. It is really wonderful to see the depth of commitment of people who take off from work, call in sick, whatever they have to do to come. And the other thing that you said about going into these offices, I want people to know that we don't go in with already set up meetings, because when we ask for meetings, we usually never get them or never hear from them. So we just walk into these rooms, and we have been in some of the same rooms over and over again. And what we hear from the younger staff, as Taz was implying, is please come back again. Please keep coming. This is really important. I can't tell you enough how your visits make a difference on the inside, in the way that the narrative is changing, in the way that our boss is talking about these issues. And not only do we talk to the staff, but we do what's called bird dogging, which is a run after the members of Congress as they're going into hearings, as they're coming out into hearings. We have it down to a science where we see that one is standing up and getting ready to leave the room, and we send a team out to various possible exit doors so that we can catch them. And it is important. Sometimes we have serious conversations. Sometimes we're just running after them saying, how many Palestinians will have to die before you will call for a ceasefire? Mm-hmm. You on this call know how hard it is to get a meeting with a senator. You have to be a major donor or represent some huge organization to get a private meeting. This is one of the only ways that we can actually talk to them. So it has been very important. And I want to say that the Congress is on recess this week. Next week, the Senate will be in session. And the week after that, the House and the Senate will be in session. If any of you can come and join us or know people who can, please do. That's the week of March 4th to 8th. We know that this supplemental package for $14 billion more for Israel is going to pop up again. It's going to rear its ugly head. That week of March 4th is also the week of the State of the Union, and it's the week of International Women's Day. So there will be big protests around those issues as well. So that's a great week if you're considering coming to join us. And of course, we do appreciate all the calls that people are making on a regular basis into their offices. In fact, there are people who come with us to say, I wake up in the morning and the first thing I do is make a call to my two senators and my member of Congress. And I think that's a great wake up action to do. So Marcy, do you have any maybe final questions for us?
I'm sure that our audience will have a lot of questions. And so what I want to do is reserve some time for that. And we'll move on to our next speaker. But Taz, we are really honored to have you with us tonight. So thank you. And thank you for being on Capitol Hill. I mean, I think it's very powerful to have somebody with family in Gaza visiting these offices. These congresspeople, they need to look you in the eye, right?
And that's sort of why one of the biggest reasons I joined is like, I'm personally, like, my background there I wasn't very much involved in activism, especially because, you know, I think a lot of Palestinians, especially who moved to the US, can attest to this. You know, we're told to keep our identity hidden because of fear of being doxxed, because of fears of just being like targeted for our identity. And you know, and I say this also to add to Medea's point about, like, if anyone in this call knows people or they themselves can join us, I can't tell you how much we need you and how powerful it feels as well. And how, like, the first time I went, I was super nervous and I had no idea that I could literally just walk in. Like, I just walked into a Senate building, met up with the group there that day, and we were going senator to senator, just making our points and speaking with them. And, you know, if you are on sort of, on the fence about really like joining an action, I highly recommend that you do, because I can't think of a better decision I've made in recent times, truly.
Thank you. Thank you, Taz. We'll get back to you soon. Our next speaker is Nikolai Petru. He is an author. He's a political science professor at the University of Rhode Island. I read his book, The Tragedy of Ukraine. It's a fabulous book about the roots of the tension in Ukraine. And Nikolai Petru has also been a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow. He served as Special Assistant for Policy toward the Soviet Union in the US Department of State. His other books, besides The Tragedy of Ukraine, include Ukraine in Crisis, Crafting Democracy, The Rebirth of Russian Democracy, and others. So welcome, Dr. Nikolai Petru. And I think you're gonna be telling us about why the supplemental, which includes $60 billion for Ukraine, in addition to the $14 billion for Israel for transfer of weapons and another, I think it's $8 billion to militarize East Asia for a confrontation with China, prohibition against funding for UNRWA, and the ability for the president, the White House, to bypass congressional notification on weapons shipments. Why this is not the answer, certainly as it regards to Ukraine. And then after we hear from you, Ray McGovern, who's with us, former CIA analyst, will be joining me and Medea for a conversation. So take it away, Dr. Petro.
Thank you very much, Medea and Marcy. So I'm going to try to give you in 10 minutes or less an impartial analysis of the problem with U.S. funding of the war in Ukraine. An impartial analysis has to begin by reviewing what the current policy has accomplished, and then use that as a baseline to assess what will happen if we continue on the same course. This is actually not very hard to do, since those who favor continued war funding make four claims about how this war has improved America's national security. First, they say Ukraine is winning the war. Second, that NATO has expanded. Third, that the Russian economy is collapsing. And fourth, that the Russian army has been decimated. These points were in fact made last week at the Munich Security Conference by Senator Lindsey Graham, who therefore concludes that American support for the war in Ukraine continues to be, and I quote, a good investment for the American people, end quote. Unfortunately, the senator's information is incorrect. Ukraine is currently losing the war. After surprising Russian forces in the summer of 2022, it sought to break the Russian supply lines connecting eastern and southern Ukraine, Donbas and Crimea, but was unable to do so. In a string of subsequent defeats, Ukraine wound up losing significant territory and manpower in 2023. Russia is now clearly on the offensive. Second, NATO expansion actually means much less than is commonly thought. While formally neutral, Sweden and Finland were already integrated into NATO operations, conducting joint regional defense and logistics operations together. In Russian military planning scenarios, they were always assumed to be NATO assets. Their value to NATO is largely in terms of public relations, not security. Third, the Russian economy is not collapsing. In fact, it grew faster than all G7 economies last year and is predicted to do so again in 2024. In power purchasing parity, Russia even became Europe's largest economy last year, overtaking Germany. And while the IMF expects the Russian economy to shrink eventually in 4 to 5 years' time, this is only compared to the IMF's own pre-war forecast. In other words, it is a loss of what might have been had Russia never invaded, rather than of actual economic production. Finally, Russia's army has not been decimated. Losses on both the Ukrainian and Russian sides have been horrific. But while Russia may have lost anywhere from 50,000 to 150,000 souls, for a population of 100 to 145 million, this is far less devastating than the 200 to 500,000 losses estimated for Ukraine out of a population of just 30 million, a ratio of 1 to 100 versus 1 to 1,400. In 2023, Russia also added 400,000 new recruits, while Ukraine added just 100,000. Less than half the number it hoped to recruit. Moreover, as Ukraine's weapons supplies have dwindled, Russian supplies have ramped up. According to the head of Estonian military intelligence, current Russian stockpiles will allow it to supply its army at the current rate for over a year. For Ukraine, meanwhile, the U.S. Army is currently spending its own money from its own budget to support Ukraine. Since the Western equipment given to Ukraine was rapidly depleted during last summer's counteroffensive and is not likely to be restored anytime soon, many military analysts now agree with the former Inspector General of the German Armed Forces, Harald Kujat, that the growing disparity in military capacity now makes Ukraine's defeat inevitable. According to Senator J.D. Vance, The White House admits as much in private. To sum up, therefore, further military assistance by the United States to Ukraine would be unsound because it has failed to achieve its objectives. Indeed, it has backfired. Further expenditures of money to continue the same policy will only deepen this failure. But here the defenders of the war believe they have an ace up their sleeve. The reason that the policy has failed so far, they suggest, is because the West has never committed to the victory over Russia and did not support Ukraine sufficiently. With enough money, they say, Ukraine's victory is assured. Just how much money? We know, because just talking about it is one of the things that got the head of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, Valery Zaluzhny, fired earlier this month. In an interview last December, Zaluzhny pointed out that a mere $61 billion U.S. dollars would not suffice to liberate all of Ukraine. That, he said, would require 5 to 7 times that amount, or $350 to $400 billion. Well, my time is just about run out, so let me leave you with a few points made by Ambassador Chaz Freeman. Ambassador Freeman has served with distinction in nearly every branch of our foreign policy as U.S. Ambassador to China and Saudi Arabia, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense, and former Acting Director of National Intelligence. He therefore has a wealth of insight to offer. Here are four lessons he would like us to ponder when thinking about the war in Ukraine. Number one, Russia has been militarily strengthened, not weakened by this war. It has been reoriented and freed from Western influence, not isolated. Second, combating Russia to the last Ukrainian, says Ambassador Freeman, was always an odious strategy. And now NATO is about to run out of Ukrainians. Third, democracies lose when cheerleading replaces objectivity in reporting and governments prefer their own propaganda to the truth. And finally, wars never decide who is right. They only determine who is left. Thank you.
At this point, it's my pleasure to introduce Ray McGovern, who was a CIA analyst who focused on Russian relations, with also relations with China and Europe. While he briefed President Lyndon Johnson, perhaps others, you'll tell us, on a daily basis, Ray McGovern is a founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS. He's written extensively about both Ukraine and Gaza, asserting that Israel used the October 7th attack as a pretext for the pre-existing master plan to rid Gaza of Palestinians, whose presence blocks the establishment of Greater Israel with sovereign control over the West Bank and Gaza. Ray has testified before the United Nations. He has a website. He has a wealth of knowledge and information. So welcome, Ray. Great to have you with us on Code Pink Congress. And I hope that you and Medea, if she wants to jump in, we can have a conversation that will be insightful and revelatory for our participants, because you have a lot, obviously, a lot of insight into how the CIA works and so forth. So I want to start off with just a question about what you think about William Burns, the head of the CIA, who years ago warned successive administrations that if you try to surround Russia, if you encourage Ukraine to join NATO, that will be a red line and will lead to something horrific. So what do you think of him now?
He's a cog in the wheel of the machinery. A word about Chaz Freeman first. I'm really glad that Nikolai quoted from Chaz Freeman, because when Nikolai mentioned that Chaz Freeman was for a time the head of the National Intelligence Council, I want you all to know that that was for 6 hours. 6 hours was Chas Freeman, head of the National Intelligence Council, which has purview over the president's daily brief and national intelligence estimates. It doesn't get any more important. 6 hours? Yeah. It took 6 hours for the lobby to get him, for the lobby to tell Obama, oh, no, no, this guy is too risky. He has a measured response to what's going on in the Middle East. Can't have him heading analysis. That's a new record. I don't know of any high intelligence official who did not require Senate confirmation. This was just a very high, it was a lower post than Chas had occupied. So I'm just trying to set the stage here. Yeah, Chas Freeman was head of the National Intelligence Council for 6 hours one day. So, okay, now what about this guy, William Burns? He was told on the 1st of February, 2008, look, it was Lavrov, the foreign minister, who told him, Mr. Burns, we have, do you know what Niet means? And Burns said, oh, yeah. Well, Niet means Niet. That's a red line, no admission of Ukraine or Georgia to NATO, 1st of February. Burns played it straight. He reported that back, the title of his cable, which we have by virtue of WikiLeaks, by the way. And if I've seen one cable from Embassy Moscow, I've seen about, well, thousands, okay? He reported back and he said, in the title, Niet means Niet, Russia's red lines on admission of Ukraine or Georgia to NATO. Okay, so this is 2008. 2 months later, Bush and Cheney succeeded in browbeating people like Angela Merkel and the president of France. They said, well, all right. So the declaration in Bucharest on the 3rd of April, 2008 was Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. Now, Burns knows that. He put it in his memoirs. Now, what Lavrov also told him on the 1st of February, 2008 is, look, we have strategic interests in Ukraine. If you admit Ukraine to NATO, there will probably be a civil war in Ukraine. We will have to decide whether or not to intervene. Do you get that, Mr. Burns? Yeah, I get that. And as I say, he reported back matter-of-factly. What does William Burns say now? Oh, what a terrible thing the Russians did. It was completely unprovoked. And yet, for those who want a bottom line here, Lavrov said, you would provoke us. And now Burns, having forgotten all this, is saying, totally unprovoked. So, answer to your question, sorry to take on so long. Burns is a cog in the wheel, and he just does what the president tells him to do, or what his nominal boss, Avril Haines, the existing National Intelligence Director, tells him to do. It's a waste.
Okay. Medea has a question. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, Ray, the U.S. has been either trying to sabotage negotiations, as happened early on in the war, and as recently as the end of last year and the beginning of this year, Reuters has reported that the Russians had reached out to the United States to talk directly to the U.S., but the U.S. nixed that as well. But the narrative that we hear from the White House is constantly Russia will not negotiate. Even when Tucker Carlson had that long interview with Putin and Putin talked about being ready to negotiate, the U.S. response was, no, he's not serious. On the other hand, as Nikolai just told us, he says the Russians are in a good position, and so it would be in their interest to continue this war. So are the Russians serious about wanting to negotiate?
Well, Mattia, good questions, as usual. The proof is in the pudding. The Russians did negotiate. A week after the war started, there were feelers sent up from Kiev and from Moscow. My God, this is awful. let's see if we can end this damn thing. Negotiators from both sides, Russian and Ukrainian, met in Belarus and then in Istanbul in Turkey. They worked out a deal, ceasefire. Ukraine remains neutral. Other things worked out in a codicil. What happened? They were just about to not only initial it, but sign it when the U.S. came in. They say Boris Johnson came in. Yeah, he did, actually. But the idea was we told Zelensky, no deal. You do that, and we're not going to support you anymore. If you turn that down, then we will support you for as long as it takes with increased weaponry and everything else. Now we don't say for as long as it takes anymore. We say, the president says, for as long as we can. And given the situation in Congress, we can't anymore. So that leaves these people in the lurch, Zelensky and so forth. But again, the proof is in the pudding. The Russians did negotiate. We nixed it at the very beginning. We're talking late March, early April 2022. Now, since then, Zelensky was persuaded to put into Ukrainian law a provision that says Zelensky himself can't negotiate with the Russians. And this is a point, of course, that Putin made. How am I going to negotiate with the Ukrainians if their law forbids it? Are the Russians ready to negotiate? Of course they are. Who would they negotiate with? Well, presumably the Ukrainian, but they know who's running the show. It would be with the Wicked Witch of the West, Victoria Nuland. Yeah, okay. And she came 10 days ago to Ukraine. The place has fallen apart. The Russians have just overcome the main obstacle to going all the way to the Dnieper River. And there was confusion in the leadership, Zelensky and Zaluzhny, and then Victoria Nulansky came in, and Zaluzhny was cashiered. Shursky came in, and Shursky committed some of their most prized reserves to relieve Azeyevka. And as usually happens, surveillance found these prized reserves, decimated them, and now Azeyevka, the key. You should know, Adeyevka is from whence the Ukrainian army was shelling the civilians in Donetsk City, okay? Since 2014, okay? 14,000 until the war, a couple thousand after that. So that's gone now. So the situation is that Russia's willing to negotiate? Of course they are, but they're willing, they always say, but you have to recognize the facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground happen to be that not only Crimea is part of Russia, but so are those four oblasts, or those four provinces that the Russians have claimed and that have had plebiscites now and are, in Russia's view, part of Russia.
Ray, you have inside knowledge on how an administration works. We're here tonight because we want to defeat this $95 billion supplemental. We don't want to spend another $60 billion to continue a war in Ukraine that will only profit Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman. This is a giant money laundering operation, as far as I'm concerned. And at the end of the day, you'll still have internal conflicts, as I'm sure Nikolai Petru will talk about later, between the East and the West of Ukraine. So for those who are very serious about trying to defeat this bill, where do you think would be the most strategic place to apply pressure in terms of the administration as opposed to Congress? Or maybe Congress too.
I think that Julian Assange, my friend here, is right when he says, if wars can be started with lies, they can be ended with the truth. It's our job to spread the truth around. And that's why I'm in awe at my friend Medea, Motaz, and all the others that are going doing this stuff day after day. You know, I've watched this happen before Iraq. We weren't able to prevent Iraq, but this time I think we can prevent that 60 extra billion, not 60 billion over 127 other billion. Did it work before? Of course not, as Nikolai pointed out. Now, here's a mixed quote for you, okay? It'll give you some encouragement and then something different. It's very, very small, and I used it with Larry Wilkerson in a op-ed we published on Consortium News on Friday. Two sentences. It comes from Anthony J. Blinken. Quote, if you're playing on the military terrain of Ukraine, you're playing to Russia's strength. Because Russia is right next door. We looked at the map. It has a huge amount of military equipment and military force right on the border. Anything we did as countries in terms of military support for Ukraine is likely to be matched and then doubled and then tripled and then quadrupled by Russia. End quote. Tony Blinken, bad news. That was 2015 in Germany. He was working for Obama. Obama thought it was a dumb idea to send lethal weaponry to Ukraine. Why? Because he said specifically, because that would give the Ukrainians the idea that they might be able to prevail in a war with a much stronger Russia. So what am I saying here? I'm saying these guys lie through their teeth. They bend they're sort of like windsocks on an airport, and you just have to confront them. Hey, Tony, why did you say this back in 2015? And what has changed? Has the map changed? Have the Russians changed? What made you think you could prevail this time? Last thing is that Obama himself, on this particular issue, had his head screwed on right. He warned. He said, look, there are countries that have core interests. Russia has a core interest in Ukraine, okay? We don't. And so please be careful of where you get involved in military activities. If you don't have a core interest there, don't do it. That was Obama. Where was Biden then? I think he was vice president, but he must have been asleep. It's things like this that can sensitize people to say, my God, what's with these people? Who came in? Last thing I'll say on this is, I think it was very, very illustrative of the mindset of Joe Biden. 60 Minutes, a month ago, at the end, the interviewer says, now, Mr. President, do you think that you could take on two wars at the same time, like Ukraine and maybe Southwest Asia? And Obama looks at him and he says, we're the United States of America, the strongest country in the history of the world. Did you hear me? The history of the world, quote, end quote. That's megalomania. That's delusionary. And if Blinken and Sullivan are unwilling to get him out of this mindset, it's going to be real trouble, trouble for all of us, because wars are very easily started these days and very difficult to finish.
Thank you so much, Ray McGovern. We appreciate you joining us tonight. Yes, and we're going to ask all of our panelists to now be on screen, and we'll take questions from the chat. We'll ask a few of our own, and we'll have a Q&A for about 10 minutes. And then after that, we ask that you stay with us for our Capitol calling party, because we're going to be calling Capitol Hill, talking to our Congress members, senators, House representatives, and saying, or leaving messages, they usually take messages, that we want them to vote against this supplemental, this $95 billion supplemental, with $60 billion for Ukraine and $14 billion for another transfer of weapons for genocide in Gaza for Israel. And we want also to call the office of the ranking member of the House, that's Hakeem Jeffries. The Republicans control the House. So Hakeem Jeffries is the ranking member, and he has said that he wants to issue a discharge petition. If the Republicans will not bring the supplemental to the floor, because the Freedom Caucus of the Republican Party is opposed to the money being spent for Ukraine, and they want more money to militarize the border. So for that reason, if Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, says, I'm not going to bring this to the floor, then Hakeem Jeffries wants to push a discharge petition with a majority vote of Congress to force a vote on this supplemental. So that's what we're looking at possibly in March. And we want to leave a message for him too. So thank you for staying with us and continue. Please continue to stay with us. All right, let's start our question and answer session with our panelists. Medea, you want to start off?
Yes, I have one question that I'd like Ray to answer and then Nikolai and then one question for Taz. On the issue of Ukraine, is there a rational voice somewhere in this administration? Might it be coming from the Pentagon? What's the difference between what the National Security Council is saying, what the State Department is saying, what the Pentagon is saying, and how might that influence how we try to stop this money from going through? And then for Taz, if you could just talk about this in terms of the Palestinian American community and this campaign that's been going about Genocide Joe, Abandon Biden, how you think this might influence the upcoming election. So Ray, could we start out with you?
Sure. I'm sort of an optimistic type by bent, but the answer to your question, in my view, is no. There is no rational voice in our administration. Now, the only saving grace is that there are some people in the armed forces who know what nuclear war would result in. There are others that think we can use a little mini nuke to scare the Russians and give the US administration time to get through November and the election. There is a real drive not to lose the war in Ukraine, which is already pretty much lost, because if you lose the war in Ukraine, you lose the election. And then if you lose the election, you could lose your freedom if that other guy comes in and uses all the evidence already amassed about bribery and everything else. I kid you not, these people are afraid of that. So my answer here is there aren't any reasonable people. There are just the opposite. There are people who have a personal stake in preventing the Russians from having an overtly big win in Ukraine. And what they might do scares the hell out of me, because I do not rule out they would pick some of these naive armed forces people who think they can use a mini nuke and think that would save the situation, save their own hides when, if the the other guy wins, it comes out that way. So no, there are no reasonable people. I'd be interested in what Nikolai thinks.
Yeah, I have found both in government and as a private citizen out of government that there are a lot of individual rational people who are actually quite interested, quite willing to listen to your opinions. The problem is that they are constrained and limited by their professional obligations to carry out the policy of the administration. And at some point you reach a wall and you find yourself carrying out policies that you cannot support. And at that point, as we've seen in the past, a professional diplomat doesn't have much choice. They have to resign because they can no longer conduct that policy. And so we lose a lot of good people that way. So there's two things that limit the ability of wise people to influence policy. One is if the administration itself is hell-bent on war, and we've seen what that leads to in the past in other areas of the world. And secondarily, institutional discipline and constraints. But as individuals, no, there are a lot of I found very intelligent and reasonable and sensible people. It's just they cannot act on what they know to be true. And in order to do that, they really have to leave the system and try to influence it from the outside, which is a very, very difficult thing to do.
Thank you. And then, Medea, you had a question for Taz as well.
Yes, Taz, the issue of how, and you know, we're quite far from the election, so there might be a lot of enthusiasm now in the abandoned Biden, but do you think it will last until election time?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think I would say that it will most certainly last. And I think part of that is we're sort of at a kind of a pivotal moment in Arab American political engagement, because it is the first time that we're sort of shifting towards actually unifying our voice and understanding that we as Arab Americans and also as Muslim Americans as well, there's an ability for us here to actually influence the election. I mean, Michigan is one of the swing states, and there are also other Arab American populations across the country, and we have a chance to actually influence the election. And from all the people I've talked to who are Arab American, I really, really don't think that there's sort of going to be any wavering in terms of that stance. I know personally for me, there isn't anything in the world that Joe Biden could do for me to vote for him. And, you know, I want to remind also that obviously that's not an endorsement of Trump. That's just us sort of exercising our, you know, I think that's what a democracy is about. You know, like the Democratic establishment and Joe Biden in particular have let us down in every way, shape, and form. Joe Biden has, you know, consistently and even recently shared sort of these stories that have already been debunked from earlier in the war, in the genocide. The administration, you know, I watch like Matt Miller every day, the spokesperson for the White House, and don't get me started on Kirby. They're just, you know, spouting these lies day after day. And I mean, a great example from just earlier today that there's a report that came out about Israeli soldiers, actually, like there are allegations against them raping Palestinian women. And when questioned about it, you know, it's, we've heard, we're looking into, you know, how credible the sources are. But when the Israeli media just straight up says whatever, it's taken as this is, you know, God's word, like there's no doubt about it. So I would say as Arab Americans, to conclude, I think we see just how hypocritical the Democratic establishment has been. We see just how, you know, genocidal Joe Biden has been, just seemingly unrelenting in his stance to keep the war going. And, you know, trying, like going to Michigan and trying to meet with literally any like imam or anywhere that will take him, and everyone is saying no because enough is enough. It's and you know, there's a lot of like discourse in liberal circles of like, but you're gonna let Trump win, he's worse. Is he probably worse? Yes, I mean, honestly, probably he would be even worse than Joe Biden. But that being said, you still can't expect us to vote for someone who just threw us under the bus, is continuing the genocide. And when Palestinian Americans die, they're not given any sort of like there's Wadia in Chicago, there's Tawfiq, the 17-year-old in the West Bank, Palestinian American 17-year-old who died, and there was nothing said about that. So yeah, I don't think people are going to waver. And, you know, I'll end it with, come November, we will remember.
Moataz Salim, a guest on Code Pink Congress, who joined Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, and Nikolai Petro. professor and author of The Tragedy of Ukraine.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Danny Bush knows the Carlisle.